Guardian Unlimited.
Hello, my name's John Dennis. This is News Desk, and it's Wednesday, October the 24th. Today, peace talks between the Israelis and Palestinians, and hosted by the US, seem doomed to failure, not least because Hamas controls Gaza, where life for supporters of the opposing Palestinian faction, Fatah, is bleak.
You can feel that you are in a police state, if you can say that. You are under control. We are in a place that you feel that every second you can be arrested for no reason, but you are a Fatah member.
40 years after abortion was legalised in the UK, you'll hear the views of campaigners and practitioners. And as police target the music piracy website Oink, should its 180,000 users be worried? Talks have been convened by the US Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice later this year in Annapolis in Maryland, bringing together the Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert and the Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas. Mr. Abbas, of course, no longer controls half the Palestinian territory. In a rare visit by a Western journalist, The Guardian's Clancy Chasse has been to Hamas-controlled Gaza.
Since the fighting between Hamas and Fatah in June this year, Gaza has faced crushing international isolation. Fewer and fewer foreign reporters are entering the strip since the kidnapping of BBC journalist Alan Johnston. I went into Gaza as the stranglehold over it intensified to find out how its people and their leaders were coping. Gazans say things are more stable since Hamas took over, but as I learnt, stability in Gaza is rarely calm. Friday prayers in Gaza City. This is Hamas's security force in action. I am told they are beating these men because they are known troublemakers working for Fatah. But scenes like this give credence to Fatah spokesmen, who claim that Hamas is turning Gaza into a brutal police state.
You can feel that you are in a police state, if you can say that. You are under control. We are in a place that you feel that every second you can be arrested for no reason, but you are a Fatah member.
But Fatah is inflicting its own form of brutality. A few days into my visit, I spot a very orderly demonstration through the streets of Gaza City. These people are all doctors and health workers. They're protesting because their salaries have been stopped, because they won't withdraw their labour. Grotesque but true, Abu Mazen's Fatah administration in Ramallah has ordered Gaza's doctors and health workers to go on strike. Those that strike have their wages paid. Those that refuse this order have had their wages cut.
Clancy Chasse reporting. And the first of his three short films is on the site today at guardian.co.uk/insidegaza. You can hear the second of his reports on Newsdesk tomorrow. And we'll also have an extract from the BBC's Alan Johnston's moving radio report about his time in captivity in Gaza. The Guardian's Jonathan Friedland says Clancy's reports provide a rare glimpse of life in Gaza.
I think they're very insightful films, and even brief as they are, you do see a lot. And one immediate lesson is that journalistically, it is possible to cover Gaza, and you realise watching them how little coverage there has been so far. And he makes the point during the films that ever since the kidnap of the BBC's Alan Johnston, there's been next to no presence journalistically in Gaza, and you realise watching these how much you've missed out. I mean, it is amazing just to see what he sees, which is he goes out with one of the Al-Aqsa brigades as they fire off a rocket into Israel over the border from Gaza. Now, the significance of that is that Israeli policy and Western policy, including British policy, is to ostracize Hamas and not deal with them for the reason and the argument being that they are a terrorist organization still committed to violence, and yet they do deal with Fatah. Well, the people launching this rocket are from Al-Aqsa, which is aligned not with Hamas, but with Fatah.
And Hamas notable absentees from talks later this year in Annapolis.
That's right. This is the planned Middle East meeting, the Americans say, deliberately downgrading it from a conference due in Annapolis. which is the subject of the column I've written in The Guardian today. And Hamas obviously deliberately absent from that because the West and America, Britain, the European Union, everybody refuses to have any dealings with them. And so they're not going to be there. But Mahmoud Abbas, the Palestinian president, the Fatah leader, will be there if the meeting indeed happens. What I've been writing today is that it's a rare day in the Middle East when everybody, from the hardliners of Hamas right through to the hawks of Likud, agree on anything, and yet they do agree that this Middle East meeting in Annapolis is pretty well doomed, and there are powerful arguments for that, and yet, you know, nevertheless, those people who are very diehard in their pursuit of peace are sticking with it, really, in the absence of anything else.
And it's partly because the authority of all the parties taking part in the talks is very weak.
That's right. That's why the immediate and probably the safe bet is to assume this thing is doomed. Then the immediate explanation for that is because the three parties, as you say, are so weak. President Bush, obviously, he's entering that lame duck period where a new presidential election is only about a year away. And I argue there that it's not even just that. It's also because his own authority internationally is so weak after the Iraq debacle. So he's not seen as being somebody who's got great political strength, and yet he's the host of the meeting. That said, the president is always the president, and so does at least have the power to convene a meeting like this. Then you have Ehud Olmert, who is so badly damaged internally, forget what the rest of the world thinks of him, just internally, by the Lebanon War of the summer of 2006, widely, universally really regarded in Israel as a series of terrible mistakes, and mired by corruption scandals. So he's, even though he enjoys a parliamentary majority, an Israeli columnist who I quoted in my own column said that he lacks moral legitimacy. He's not seen as a leader who has a sort of moral command. And finally, and weakest of all, actually, the Palestinian leader, for the reasons we've been touching on, which is that he does not command fully even the small amount of territory under him, under the Palestinian Authority. So those are the three parties. They arrive there, in other words, absolutely hobbled and weak. Perversely, that may be the one glimmer of optimism here, because they're all so weak, and they may be desperate to come away with at least something, and that means there's a convergence of interest. It is in their collective interest to at least come away with, and this I think is all Annapolis is really aiming for, a piece of paper that could work as a framework for the resolution of the issues. Not a resolution itself, but at least a framework.
Jonathan Friedland. Also on Guardian Unlimited today, the plans from Schools Secretary Ed Balls to introduce a new qualification that could eventually replace A-levels. More on that at educationguardian.co.uk. David Conn writes that racism is on the retreat in professional football, but it still blights the game at a recreational level. You can read his piece, join in the debate on that at blogs.guardian.co.uk/sport. And Jill Partingdon selects recipes such as Iraqi yogurt soup from a new cookbook celebrating the food of countries that George Bush says are rogue states. That's at guardian.co.uk/lifeandstyle. It's 40 years since women won the right to have a legal abortion in the UK. Today, Lord Steele, the architect of the 1967 Abortion Act, calls for greater sexual responsibility. He says he never anticipated anything like the current number of terminations. There were 194,000 abortions in England and Wales last year, a figure that Roman Catholic leaders said this week was a source of anguish and profound distress for us all. The Archbishop of Canterbury, Dr. Rowan Williams, warned in The Observer that abortion is now being treated as too easy to obtain. In London, the Global Safe Abortion Conference is taking place. Campaigner Anne Cosay from the lobby group Abortion Rights says that despite recent attacks, pro-choice campaigners have reason to be optimistic about the future of abortion provision in Britain.
There is a real sense that the government human tissue and embryos bill that's coming up in the autumn, so in November in the Queen's speech, may provide with opportunities for the pro-choice movement to actually table some amendments on reform. It's very obvious that the anti-choice lobby will try and amend the act as well. I mean, the main issues they have been focusing on is a reduction of the time limit. They've also been trying to impose new guidelines for access and try and curtail young people's access in terms of contraception and abortion, and also trying to impose a cooling off period, because the new thing the anti-choice lobby have been trying to highlight over the last 2 or 3 years is that abortion is terribly harmful for women. So now we're in a situation where we've managed to show that abortion and breast cancer are not linked, that abortion and infertility are not linked. So now there is a new bunny out of the bag, and its abortion causes, you know, severe psychological trauma. But again, there is no evidence of that. And when you think that one in three women in Britain will have an abortion in her lifetime, I think we would probably know that if abortion caused serious psychological trauma, that there would be an evidence of that in our society. We conducted a poll just this week, and we were very, very pleasantly surprised to find out that 83% of the UK public supports a woman's right to have an abortion. And I think that's really significant to see that, you know, as we celebrate 40 years of safe legal abortion, there is continued overwhelming support.
Anne Cosnay. Dr. Kate Patterson is a consultant gynaecologist at St Mary's Hospital in Paddington, West London. She admits there are huge issues with personnel.
Limited training time, and there are people who are opting not to train in abortion. And also it's not considered to be as high up the pecking order as, say, being an IVF doctor. I think it will create problems within the next 5 years unless we manage to address it. But I think there are several people within the system now who realise it's a problem and are looking at ways of formalising training to ensure there's a network of trainers. There are many doctors who believe passionately that abortion is important. They don't all want to do them, but there are enough around who do if we had a training network that was suitable for them.
There are differences in the provision of abortion across the UK, according to Dr. Kate Guthrie, who works with the Hull and East Riding Sexual and Reproductive Healthcare Partnership.
Some places in the country, it's very easy to access. Services are well advertised. You very quickly are seen within the unit which provides the abortion. You very quickly have your abortion. In some parts of the UK, you can wait up to 7 weeks to be seen. There's something desperately wrong, whereas a woman in the UK, where you live, dictates the standard of services you acquire. Abortion services have to be provided because it's part of the law, but different trusts take it, frankly, more seriously than others. Some are prepared to spend time, not necessarily money, it's not any more expensive to provide a good service, but some are prepared to spend time on designing and delivering a very effective service, and some aren't. Some communities have got very large numbers of abortion requests from teenagers. Some communities have black and ethnic minorities, and they may come from backgrounds with a different attitude towards abortion. Some communities, like rural communities, it's terribly difficult to keep confidentiality, and also the miles to be travelled in rural communities. There should be some sort of national template which can be applied, which will work equally well regardless of how old you are, what colour you are, and where you live.
Dr. Kate Guthrie. Now, Matt Weaver's here with a look at today's papers. Matt, a tragedy for British tourists in the Algarve.
Yeah, nearly all the papers carry the same picture on their front pages of two grinning girls, Rosie Fry and Lydia Dinsmore. And they were swept off an Algarve beach in Portugal with their brothers and were later rescued. But both Rosie's parents and Lydia's mother were drowned trying to save them. Orphaned by the ocean, says the Sun. And the Telegraph reports that Lydia's mother, Jean, was an accomplished swimmer and triathlete, but was dragged under by the strong Atlantic currents. Both the Sun and the Mirror carry the account of a local surf instructor who had warned the children not to play in the currents.
John Yates led the investigation into allegations that politicians accepted cash in return for honours. That investigation, of course, produced no charges in the end. He appeared before a Commons Select Committee yesterday.
Yeah, there's lots of excitement about his clash with the committee yesterday. Mr Yates didn't name names, but strongly suggested that Tony Blair's inner circle obstructed the investigation. He also denied leaking information to the press during the lengthy inquiry. And the sketch writers can't quite agree whether to tease the committee or Yates of the Yard, and were split about who came out on top yesterday. Quentin Letts in the Mail said that Mr Yates thrashed the pants off the committee and the MPs behaved as if politicians were above the law. But Simon Carr in the Independent says it was Mr Yates who was being smug. Anne Trenneman in The Times says Mr Yates was being theatrically coy about who had obstructed the investigation and appeared to think he was starring in his own movie.
And the anniversary of the 1956 uprising in Hungary, fresh demonstrations.
Yeah, tens of thousands of people took the streets of Budapest, apparently to commemorate the 56 uprising, but also take part in angry demonstrations against the socialist Prime Minister Ferenc Gyurcsány, according to the Herald Tribune. It says that 19 people were injured after right-wing rioters hurled petrol bombs at the rally. He had echoes of violence last year when Gyurcsány admitted that he lied about the state of the economy. Opposition politicians accuse his government of failing to stand up to a resurgent Russia, and the Prime Minister accuses them of stirring up right-wing groups.
Who does the Learning and Skills Council say would make good role models for school children?
According to the Independent, it's much maligned WAGs. they're being held up as... The Learning and Skills Council says that nine of the top WAGs have more qualifications than you might think when it comes to GCSEs. And some even have degrees, such as Lisa Ruffhead, Michael Carrick's wife. Only mega WAG Victoria Beckham has failed to make the grade, it says. Julia Dowd of the Learning and Skills Council tells the Independent that children should realise that fame and fortune is not possible without hard work. But the paper's leader writer is unconvinced. It would be better if young girls could look up to women such as the scientist Susan Greenfield or Doris Lessing.
Doris Lessing, of course, won the Nobel Prize for Literature last week, and she's been quite outspoken, hasn't she?
Yeah, according to The Telegraph, in an interview for a Spanish newspaper, she says that the September the 11th attacks were not as terrible as the IRA bombing campaign. The Telegraph points out that the attack on the Twin Towers killed nearly 3,000 people, but the IRA troubles killed 3,700 over 30 years. Lessing accuses Americans of naivety and says George Bush has been a calamity.
Anger in some of the papers about levels of immigration.
The European Union is proposing a blue card system modelled on America's infamous green card to attract highly skilled migrants to Europe, according to The Times. But Britain is likely to opt out of the scheme, as new figures predict that immigration is fueling a surge in the UK's population. Within 24 years, it says that the population is set to reach 71 million. The Guardian points out that it's also higher fertility rates and longer life expectancy that's behind the estimated increase. But many seize on immigration. Where will they all live, asks The Sun. We face an unavoidable crisis triggered by a regime which has seen mass immigration solely as a blessing. It doesn't point out that highly skilled immigrants helped English football restore some sporting pride last night in the Champions League. At last, something to celebrate, says The Sun, above a picture of Arsenal's Spanish star, Cesc Fabregas.
More on that later on. Many thanks for that, Matt. And don't forget to subscribe to The Wrap, our daily email service, a review of the papers today written by Matt. That's at guardian.co.uk/wrap. Italy's mafias earn more than the country's biggest corporation, according to a report today by the National Retailers Association. John Hooper's in Rome for The Guardian, and he's seen the report.
It says that the four main Italian mafias, not just the original mafia, the Cosa Nostra in Sicily, but those in Puglia, Calabria, and in the Naples area, together earn some 90 billion euros. That's more than 60 million pounds and more than $125 million. It's a huge sum, bigger than the turnover of Italy's biggest corporation, which is the oil giant Eni. The report says that the mafia, partly through the recycling of its gains from its core businesses of extortion and loan sharking, has infiltrated every aspect of Italy's legal economy.
How is it possible to calculate the income of criminal gangs? Because it's not as if they declare their receipts.
No, there's always going to be a very, very wide margin of error here. And I think that the attempt of the report is to try and bring home to Italian politicians just how urgent the situation is. But there are methods to get quite a long way. It's known, for example, roughly how many people pay what's called pizzo, protection money, in each of the main cities where the mafias operate. And from that you can make a deduction, because it's also known how much is actually handed over. For example, in Palermo, if you run a supermarket, you're expected to part with 5,000 euros a month. In Naples, the rate is 3,000. So you can do a census, you can multiply, you can get an idea from that. So there is some basis for it, but as I say, it's always a bit of guesswork too.
And what are the principal sources of income for the mobsters?
Well, this association, which is representing shopkeepers primarily, says that in fact loan sharking is the biggest single money spinner, even ahead of extortion. What is perhaps interesting and indeed alarming about this report is that they seem to be making no calculation for the profits from drug trafficking.
John Hooper in Rome. Now, coming up on Newsdesk, after a 7-0 victory for Arsenal last night, Kevin McCarrow previews tonight's Champions League football. But before we hear from Kevin, Oink, one of the world's largest music piracy websites, has been closed down by British police. Bobby Johnson, The Guardian's technology correspondent, says Oink was regarded as one of the most exclusive online destinations for getting hold of new music illegally.
Oink is what's known as a torrent tracker. Basically, it's a kind of index of files kept on other people's computers. So they don't host any information themselves, but they do kind of, they're a guide to how to download files from other people. Now, it was used by around 180,000 people and was kind of well known for being a really high quality source of file shared music.
Should those 180,000 users now be concerned that they'll be targeted by the police?
The music industry, what they don't actually mind downloading that much. What they don't like are the people who put the files out there in the first place. And so with Oink, in order to use it, you had to put files out there. So pretty much everybody who used the service is a probably quite a large scale uploader. Which is really what the police and the record industry are focusing on.
Now that music is available to be downloaded legally to such a widespread extent, are illegal file-sharing websites such as Oink as much of a problem to the music industry as they once were?
You know, just like with physical CDs, they would always assume there would be a certain amount of shoplifting, or there would be a certain amount of you know, people sticking it on a tape and giving it to their mates or whatever, or burning a copy for a friend. You know, file sharing remains an issue for the industry, and this is the first big action we've really seen in a little while. I think what is really interesting, this comes on the back of another investigation and the shutdown of a website called TV Links last week. Now, what that shows, that was pointing to similar information, but for TV downloading. Now, I think what this shows is this kind of increased impetus on trying to take out these large scale websites that kind of act as the middleman. People are clever now; they don't want to directly be responsible for illegal downloading, because that's clearly illegal. There's this huge grey area though, in terms of if I'm effectively a search engine and you happen to use it to get illegal content, who's responsible for that? I think what we might see out of these last two cases is that grey area being defined a little more and becoming clearer to everybody.
Bobby Johnson. Now, football. And last night, it was 7-0 to the Arsenal.
3-0 at half-time, you could say, OK, we cooled the game down and killed the game, but we kept going. I think the players enjoy the way they play, and that's why they just continue to play at a high tempo, and that's a joy to watch.
The Arsenal manager Arsene Wenger, after Theo Walcott stole the show in the Champions League last night against Slavia Prague at the Emirates Stadium. The Guardian's chief football writer is Kevin McCarra. He says the Czech side were always facing a tough match.
I think, as we were seeing yesterday, the Slavia Prague were in fact the runners-up in the Czech Republic, so not very strong, and coming to play an Arsenal side in tremendous form, and one that also had the fillip of the 18-year-old Theo Walcott playing. He's somebody in whom the fans invest great hope, although he hasn't done a great deal until now, simply because it's such an exciting idea of a youngster coming through and making an impact, and he duly did score twice last night.
And Manchester United 4-2 winners at Dynamo Kiev. Was it as comfortable as the scoreline suggests?
Yes, I think it's a late goal, in fact, from Kiev that made it 4-2. Yes, United, having had a string of boring 1-0 wins, are now inevitably back to their normal goal-scoring form. We saw Wayne Rooney scoring for a sixth game in succession last night, something he's never come close to doing that in his career. They're in outstanding form. There's only two teams in the Champions League at present who have taken 9 points, the full 9 points in the first three games, and they're both British teams.
And Rangers drew against Barcelona. Will they see that as a good result, though?
It's a fantastic result for Rangers. They'll regret a bit that Lyon won away and Stuttgart in the same group, but Rangers have three games left, and basically if they win one of them, they're through to the last 16. and they were probably in the hardest group imaginable. So that's quite some achievement, playing against Lyon, Stuttgart and Barcelona.
And Liverpool travel to Turkish side Beşiktaş. Will they miss their injured striker Fernando Torres?
They did buy an array of strikers during the summer, or they built up an array of strikers to cover that eventuality, but certainly Torres is the best of them. Beşiktaş, again, Turkey is not as strong as it once was, and currently they have no points whatsoever in Group A, so that does sound encouraging for Liverpool. But Liverpool's own form has been kind of sterile, and they really could do with a win before they play Arsenal on Sunday.
And Chelsea looking to put their recent troubles behind them, really, with a win against Schalke.
Yes, they got back on track. I was in Valencia and Didier Drogba put on a terrific performance and they beat Valencia 2-1. And that seems to have set the club back on course and they've been winning since then. They depend terribly on Drogba, but if he's fit, then everything's possible and I would certainly expect them to beat Schalke this evening.
And your team, Kevin, Celtic, they travel to Benfica. Can they maintain their good European form?
There's 40 clubs in Scotland and only one of them has not kept a clean sheet away from home in the whole of the past year. And that club, unbelievably, is Celtic. So it doesn't augur well for Benfica. I would suggest they're going to have to score if they want to avoid defeat.
Kevin McCarra. Today's edition of News Desk was produced by Phil Maynard and Andy Duckworth. I'm John Dennis. Thank you for listening.
Guardian Unlimited.